I next met with Dr. Edward Garin, and to begin, he commented on an agent recently approved in esophagogastric cancer, the anti-VEGF antibody ramucirumab, and at ASCO, we saw the results of a phase 3 trial of this agent in lung cancer, the so-called REVEL trial, in which ramucirumab was combined with docetaxel as second-line therapy.
Ramucirumab is a monoclonal antibody targeting the VEGF receptor. So whereas bevacizumab is a monoclonal antibody that targets VEGF-A, targets the ligand, this agent instead targets the receptor. And there are several phase 1 and 2 trials in lung cancer, and really the only phase 3 trial to date is the REVEL trial. And the REVEL trial randomized patients with non-small cell lung cancer. It included squamous cell carcinoma. It also included non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer. The majority of patients were non-squamous, although a sizable minority were squamous cell patients. And this was a combination. It was compared, the combination of docetaxel and ramucirumab was compared to docetaxel alone. The study was, in my estimation, interesting on several levels. One is that the outcomes for patients in general exceeded what our anticipations were and our assumptions going into the trial. We had assumed somewhere in the 7-month range in terms of survival for patients on the control arm. We had assumed a response rate in the mid-single digits, as has been seen in other such trials. And in fact, that isn't exactly what we saw. The control arm on the REVEL study, a survival over 9 months, and the response rate was in the 13% range on the control arm. Now, both of those numbers were exceeded on the study arm. So the addition of ramucirumab did lead to a survival benefit as well as a benefit in progression-free survival and overall survival. It was a study that was somewhat controversial at ASCO. Many of the questions that were asked were not entirely positive, and I think some of that revolved around the duration of benefit. And the duration of benefit was that the progression-free survival, that did end up being very similar to what was anticipated when we started the study. The control arm had a 3-month progression-free survival, and that was increased to 4.5 months. In the ramucirumab arm. Almost all of that benefit in terms of progression-free survival translated into an overall survival benefit. So the 1.5 months seen in terms of progression-free survival was almost entirely recapitulated as 1.4 months in terms of overall survival. This was controversial in the sense that there have recently been a lot of discussions at ASCO in particular about what an appropriately clinically significant duration of survival benefit would be. And I think that led to some discussion. From my perspective, one thing that ended up being very odd about the discussion is that the discussion ends up on some level, I think specifically because of the ASCO guidelines that came out, on putting people in a position where a group of experts would decide what the duration of additional life would be that would be meaningful to a patient. And on some level, I think that's really an odd construct. I don't think that makes a lot of sense. I think that for patients, anything where they live longer is going to be something that they are happy about. There's no duration of additional life that they would say, well, that's not enough for me to care about. That being said, certainly there are factors that will have to be considered when evaluating any new agent, in terms of the costs of the agent, not necessarily just financial costs, but in terms of quality of life, toxicity issues. And in my view, that's a much more constructive way to look at the benefit of the drug, to look at it in its totality, including not just what the potential benefits are, but what the potential risks of it are in a whole host of different arenas. But on some level, I don't really believe that I would be able to sit on a panel and say that there is a certain duration of additional life that is useless.
And I guess it was maybe a year or two ago, we saw 3 agents/strategies approved in advanced colorectal cancer, all 3, aflibercept, regorafenib, and Bev on progression, all 3 with around a 1.5-month advantage in survival. They're now used routinely in practice. What do we know about the impact of Bev second line? I know there was a trial in colon, but I'm not sure. Has there been one in lung before this?
So there are ongoing trials, some that may be close to completion, but we don't have definitive data on bevacizumab in a second line or previously treated setting in non-small cell lung cancer.
Right. Another area I wanted to ask you about that you just mentioned, certainly I think the most interesting thing going on in oncology, certainly in lung cancer, immunotherapy. And I see at ASCO, you were a part of a study looking at another anti-PD-1 agent, MK-3475. Can you just sort of provide a little bit of an overview of where we are with anti-PD-1 and anti-PD-L1 and where this agent you looked at fits in?
Sure. So for those people who attended ASCO and those patients who attended the lung cancer session in particular, I think on some levels they missed out on some of the most exciting things in lung cancer, as the profile for the PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors that I think may have been appropriate wasn't what was presented at ASCO. And I think there was a lot of exciting data. And I think that as the months and years roll by, the importance of that data is going to be quite clear. So inhibition of PD-1 and PD-L1 has certainly made a tremendous change in my practice, which is very different, I understand, than the practice of many in your audience. In a general practice, many people aren't going to have access to this class of drugs. However, this class of drugs is making a very significant and meaningful impact in many of the patients who are being evaluated in the context of clinical trials. And I've had to overhaul my entire clinic just to accommodate the demand from patients for this class of agents. So to date, there have been reports on multiple agents. I would say the three leading agents are nivolumab, pembrolizumab, which just received its generic name. The presentations have largely been under the name MK-3475. And in melanoma, there was a New England Journal of Medicine article that used the name lambrolizumab, which has subsequently been changed, as I say, to pembrolizumab, and MPDL, which is a PD-L1 inhibitor. These agents have shown, on some level, remarkably similar results with response rates in the 20% range. And this is really largely in a previously treated patient population, although Nirisvi at ASCO did demonstrate in a frontline setting similar and maybe slightly better results in that group of patients. The response rate, as I say, has hovered around 20%. You can make an argument, and the drug companies certainly have, this one looks better here, this one looks better there, but in totality, they all look quite good compared to what we would expect. The response rate, although exciting in this previously treated patient group, is perhaps not as relevant as the duration of response among the responders. There's almost a whole new way of looking at clinical trial data that has come up as a result of these trials. So swimmer's plots, for instance, are something that at least I had not been used to seeing. A swimmer's plot basically looks like the lanes of a swimming pool, showing the length of time a patient is on therapy. And what has been remarkable is that in the patients who have done well across these agents, they have tended to do quite well. And that has been a source of excitement. As I say, it certainly has captured the imagination of patients who have been extremely eager to participate in trials of this class of drugs. Although there are certainly over time going to be differences that one can find between the drugs or among the drugs that are being evaluated to date, I think they look in many respects more similar than different. But they do look different than what has been available before them. The toxicity profile has generally been quite good. The most feared toxicity to date has been pneumonitis. The biggest issue with pneumonitis was in the initial trial of nivolumab. I don't say that because I think nivolumab has some sort of unique toxicity of pneumonitis, but because they were first, I think that there may have been a lack of appreciation of how to deal with that toxicity, as would be the case with any new drug or new class of drugs. And I'm hopeful that as people get familiar with this class of drugs, that even those toxicities, which were rare, will be able to be in most cases managed.
About how many patients have you treated on study with one of these agents?
We've treated over 100 at UCLA.
Wow. So you mentioned the swimmer plot, which I love. I love the waterfall plot one. It didn't come out that long ago. I think it was maybe 10 years ago people started showing it. But another kind of plot that I like a lot that I've been seeing a lot with these immune treatments is the spider plot, where you can see individual patients, and particularly this thing about, quote, pseudoprogression. Have you observed that in your patients? And what do you typically see and what do you typically do?
So it is interesting. For many of your audience who has a more general practice, I think that they will see a lot of places where the spider plot is of particular relevance. So a spider plot, for those who haven't sat through as many presentations on this class of drugs as I have, is a plot where they basically take individual patients and show the radiographic appearance, not obviously what the scans look like, but some way they take the size of the lesions in aggregate and show the growth or reduction. And what one sees in melanoma, for instance, is that there are many patients where you will have an initial pseudoprogression, where on the spider plot, the leg initially goes up and then goes down as someone improves. Now, what I would say is that overall, and I haven't seen a formal analysis of this to date, but I would say the spider plot in lung cancer tends to go directionally. There tend to be less people where the leg goes up initially and then goes down as compared to some of the other malignancies that have been evaluated. What I would say is, in general, after treating a lot of patients, as I say, between myself and my colleague Jonathan Goldman at UCLA, we've treated together over 100 people with this class of agents, and we tend to see a very rapid response in the patients who have a response. So by the time of the first imaging assessment, we tend to have a sense of how a patient is doing, whether they are getting better or worse. And that has generally remained true, I would argue, that at that first set of imaging, we have had a sense. Now, there are a few cases, for instance, where our sense is the patient has done quite well, and the imaging doesn't necessarily match up. We have had cases go both ways with respect to that. We have had cases where the imaging just didn't pick up what we were seeing clinically. And unfortunately, we have had cases where the grossly beneficial clinical effects didn't carry through. And so I think there's still going to be a tremendous amount to learn from these agents. There's such enthusiasm, but when one looks at the actual numbers of patients who have been treated with lung cancer worldwide, it still is not that tremendous.
Another thing that you kind of take away from this is that it's interesting in that it seems to be effective in squamous cell, and I haven't been able to figure out whether there are enough patients to determine if it's actually more effective in squamous or non-squamous. Any thoughts about that?
So the question is whether there's a difference based on squamous versus non-squamous histology. So in the original data, the first set of data looked more promising in squamous cell carcinoma than it did in non-squamous cell carcinoma. And in fact, their pivotal trials are broken down into squamous and non-squamous trials. I would say that as time has gone on, it has become less clear, at least to me, that there is a difference based on histology. The one thing that some groups have now reported, the MPDL, so the Roche Genentech drug, they reported that. We also have now at ASCO reported similar things. There is a greater response rate in patients who have been prior smokers to date. So certainly squamous cell carcinoma is almost exclusively seen in smokers. Adenocarcinoma, the great majority are smokers, but a slightly lesser group.
I've heard a lot of things about checkpoint inhibitors, but I haven't heard that one. Any theories about why it might be more effective in smokers?
Almost all talks about why this would be more effective in smokers focuses on one journal article where they basically looked at multiple different histologies and evaluated the mutational load. And when one looks at the mutational load, this study actually broke down lung cancer into squamous and non-squamous. And I believe the top three were melanoma, squamous and non-squamous lung cancer. And so those have the highest mutational load. The idea has been that smokers, based on an exposure type malignancy, are going to have a high mutational load, whereas somebody, for instance, with an EGFR mutation is not necessarily going to have a high mutational load like someone who has smoking-induced cancer. What I would say to date, that is still an interesting theory. I don't think we have the empiric data yet that will answer that question definitively. But there still have been responses, certainly in patients without smoking histories or without significant smoking histories.
I have heard that mutational load thing talked about, and I was like, well, what has that got to do with melanoma? And then it was pointed out to me that it's an extrinsic carcinogenic disease, but is that the reason? Is it the sunlight?
That is the presumption.
What about PD-L1 as a marker for predictiveness? I saw that you looked at that in your study on MK-3475, or the new name. Where are we now? Do you see clinical benefit in patients without PD-L1?
So one thing that has been unique about the pembrolizumab development program is that there has been a very large focus on the biomarker. And all the patients on trial needed to undergo a biopsy within 60 days of treatment. At the end of the trial, there may be some change, but everyone needed to have a biopsy after their last therapy. And in the pembrolizumab trial specifically, we needed to know whether or not there was any staining in terms of PD-L1 for most of the cohorts. So what happened is that I presented data in Sydney, Australia at the World Lung Conference in the fall of last year, fall of 2013. And there we reported, you know, our response rates a little bit upwards of 20%. And what we showed is that in the patients for whom we had adequate tissue, all of the people who had had the best responses, at least by the immune-related response criteria, all of those people were the people who had the highest PD-L1 expression. So we then evaluated in more of a formalized training set PD-L1 expression as a biomarker for the efficacy of the drug. So Lena Gandhi at the AACR this past year presented data, the AACR conference in San Diego, presented data showing that when we looked at our data set, there was a significant enhanced effect in patients who had PD-L1 staining in greater than 50% of the tumor cells by immunohistochemistry. So that group of patients did quite well overall, much better than patients who had less than 50% staining by IHC. And in fact, the patients who had less than 50% staining by immunohistochemistry did about the same as patients who had no staining by IHC for PD-L1. One of the issues that comes up in this, which at some level may be something we would describe as being a good problem to have, but in evaluating our biomarker, in previously treated non-small cell lung cancer, where the anticipated outcome is unfortunately so poor, our poor group or our bad group doesn't do badly enough to make us feel great about excluding them from this exciting therapy. So I believe the number we reported at ASCO was a 9% response rate in the PD-L1 negative group. That was certainly clearly less good than the 23% response rate in the PD-L1 positive group. But if you looked on the swimmer plot, for instance, the people who made up those PD-L1 negative patients who did well, they seemed to confer the exact same benefits as the PD-L1 positive patients did in that same setting. So the issue is, in a situation where the comparator for patients with one prior treatment may have been docetaxel, and for some of those patients who may have had 2, 3, 4, 5 prior treatments, who knows what the appropriate comparator would be, that 9% response rate with a long progression-free survival that still looks pretty good. And it makes it a little bit difficult, the idea that you would necessarily never treat those patients with this agent, because some of them did have a response, and that response may, at least by eyeballing it in a non-randomized setting, doesn't look inferior to what would be anticipated with the standard therapy.
Can you talk about your clinical experience related to the issue of pneumonitis and how your experience compares globally to what's been observed in the trials?
Pneumonitis is a very tricky toxicity to gauge. In my particular experience is that my way of viewing pneumonitis is probably different than it would be for someone in the community, because I've been so involved with these drugs and I've had such a great desire to understand what is going on that when I've seen this sort of toxicity, we have been very aggressive in getting biopsies and, unfortunately, on some occasions, autopsies to determine what the cause has been. So what I would say is that there are cases where clinically I have suspected pneumonitis, but when we have gotten the objective data, it has not supported that.
So in terms of efficacy, I'm going to guess, because I hear stories like this all the time, Dave Spiegel told us about a really interesting elderly woman he had who's still in a remission of, I think it was anti-PD-L1 in a couple of years with squamous cell. I'm assuming you have patients who you can clinically say these people are doing way better than they would have done if we hadn't given them anything. They're alive. They wouldn't be alive. Is that like one or two or a bunch of them?
For us, I would say the answer is a bunch. And as I say, this has been a major and very exciting part of my practice. There is a part of my clinic day that I call high five rounds where, it doesn't take very long, but per protocol, I need to see all of these people. And so I go and I see them and examine them. But the sort of questions I ask revolve around their golf game and how work is going.
Really?
That is a major, major difference to me. So do I have randomized data to say that those people's golf score wouldn't be just as good if they weren't on this agent? I do not. But do I believe it? Yeah, I think that for a lot of them, the only people whose scores would be better are the people who would be able to score only zeros.
When you're talking about the PD-L1 ligand, I think that I've been hearing that there might be some issue with quality control with the antibody, or is it a very simple thing to do?
So I don't believe that it's necessarily a quality control issue with the antibody, but there are all sorts of issues regarding the antibody. So one, based partly on the regulatory structure that everyone faces, there has been a push on all of the different companies to look at their own biomarker. So for instance, in this case, Merck has its own PD-L1 antibody. Roche has its own. Bristol-Myers Squibb looks at its own. And there are multiple questions that come up. I wouldn't call it quality control as much, because quality control would indicate that one questions whether you would get the same result with the same test each time. That may be an issue. I don't think anyone's looked, no one's at least reported looking in a rigorous fashion at that. But we don't know, for instance, if somebody was PD-L1 positive by Merck's assay, that they would also be PD-L1 positive by Roche's assay. We don't know whose assay is right. And we also haven't seen data to indicate to us that if you tested the same patient's tumor at multiple times, that you would necessarily see the same result for PD-L1 testing. So I think it has less to do with the test characteristics itself as how good a surrogate it is.
It's interesting. One final paper I want to ask you about, as I see you have this paper in the journal Thoracic Oncology, phase 2 study looking at PEM and a platinum in stage 3 AB disease. Can you just kind of review, because it seemed like there was a lot of interest in PEM and stage 3 disease, and then, we had some data came out, and now there does, to me it seems like there's not that much interest. What sort of happened there? What was the hope, and how did it pan out?
So we did evaluate a study. The actual scientific study on that question, I would argue, is not a fascinating one. Patients were randomized in addition to pemetrexed and radiation to either carboplatin or cisplatin. So the scientific question of carboplatin or cisplatin was not necessarily fascinating, and I would argue maybe wasn't even definitively proven between the two regimens. But it was a predecessor to a randomized study comparing cisplatin, pemetrexed, and radiation to cisplatin, etoposide, and radiation. Cisplatin, etoposide, and radiation it's not a very convenient regimen. It's not the easiest regimen to take or to give. And so I think that there was a lot of interest in using pemetrexed in that setting. Now, the study that we had, only midway through the study, was the association between pemetrexed and non-squamous disease noted. So there were many squamous cell carcinoma patients on that as well. I believe that there has been a press release that a randomized study comparing the regimen, the pemetrexed-based regimen, to the etoposide-based regimen, it basically was closed for futility. So in terms of efficacy, it's not going to be clearly shown that a pemetrexed-based regimen is superior to an etoposide regimen. What I think is still not known are things like the side effect profile and things like that. I think that's data that I would be interested to see. It is possible that even though that regimen is not better, that it may be similarly good or even numerically better, but with a favorable toxicity profile, we don't know. But in terms of at least the primary endpoint, it is not a positive study.
So are there any situations right now where you use PEM in stage 3 disease?
So it is interesting. So we were involved in the phase 2 study there, which looking at the cis versus carbo. We were not involved in the phase 3 trial, and that put us in a situation where off protocol, this was a question that we were asked very frequently. I had to explain to patients the differences in the side effect profile, but also to explain that the efficacy data was not yet known. And for me, it was even a more difficult situation than that because the efficacy comparatively was not yet known, but there would be an answer eventually. And so that when given the choice, at least prior to any data on the efficacy, the patients always chose the pemetrexed-based regimen. Now knowing that it is at least not better, although we don't know any more information than that, there has been a little bit more of a shift, but there are still patients in whom I do use it.
Any clinical estimate of toxicity comparatively when you use PEM?
So I don't have comparative data from the PEM. What I do find is that my bias has been that it has been a more tolerable regimen in general, although just like I mentioned in the clinic, there's always the possibility that the empiric data could come out differently. It is possible that then when this data is reported that it does not show that. It does not show that it is more tolerable, although that is my bias. One major issue that comes up in these stage 3 patients is that although we always describe chemoradiotherapy as our standard in those patients, if one looks, the median age for the patients who were on these clinical trials of these very aggressive chemoradiotherapy regimens are very different than what is seen in a general oncology practice. You're not seeing the 84-year-olds getting cis etoposide and radiation, even though that may be what a practitioner is seeing in their clinic. So I think this is very much an unmet need. And even if there are things that aren't better and potentially maybe even a little bit worse, but can be tolerated by a wider group of patients, it may be important.